As the days pass, the higher principles gradually disengage themselves from the double, and the latter then becomes in its turn an etheric corpse, which remains near the dense one, both disintegrating together. These etheric wraiths are often seen in churchyards, sometimes as violet or bluish-white mists or lights, but often presenting an unpleasant appearance as they pass through various stages of decomposition. One of the great advantages of cremation is that by destroying the dense body, the etheric body also loses its nidus and so rapidly disintegrates. If a man is so misguided as to wish to cling to the physical life, and even to his own corpse, the preservation of the dead body, either by burial or embalming, offers a distinct temptation to him to do so, and immensely facilitates his unfortunate purpose. Cremation entirely prevents any attempt at partial and unnatural temporary reunion of the principles. In addition, there are certain unpleasant forms of black magic, fortunately rare in Western countries at least, which make use of the decaying physical body. The etheric body of a dead person may also be similarly used in a variety of ways. All of these possibilities are avoided by the wholesome practice of cremation. It is quite impossible for a dead person to feel the effects of the fire on his discarded body, for, so long as it is death, the astral and etheric matter have been completely separated from the dense physical. Although it is quite impossible for a dead person to get back entirely into his dead body, yet, in the case of one who knows nothing beyond purely physical life and is crazy with fear at being entirely cut off from it, it is possible for him, in his frantic effort to keep in touch with physical life, to get hold of the etheric matter of the discarded body and drag it about with him. This may be the cause of considerable suffering, entirely unnecessary, and easily avoided by the practice of cremation. In the case of people who cling desperately to physical existence, the astral body cannot altogether separate from the etheric, and they awaken still surrounded by etheric matter. The condition is very unpleasant, as such a person would be shut out from the astral world by the shell of etheric matter, and at the same time the loss of physical sense organs prevents him from coming fully in touch with earth life. Consequently, he drifts about, lonely and dumb and terrified, in a thick and gloomy fog, unable to hold intercourse with either plane. In process of time the etheric shell wears out, in spite of his struggles, though usually not until after he has suffered intensely. Kindly people among the dead, and others, endeavor to help the class of person described, but seldom with success. Sometimes a person in this condition may endeavor to get in touch once again with the physical plane through a medium, though usually the medium's spirit guides sternly forbid them access, knowing that the medium runs the risk of being obsessed or maddened. Occasionally an unconscious medium, usually a sensitive young girl, may be seized upon, but the attempt can be successful only if the girl's ego has weakened his hold on his vehicles by indulging in undesirable thoughts and passions. Occasionally also a human soul wandering in this gray world may succeed in partially obsessing an animal, those most commonly seized upon being the less developed, cattle, sheep or swine, though cats and dogs or monkeys may also be used in this way. This appears to be the modern, that is, fifth race, substitute for the awful life of the vampire, found in fourth race peoples. Once entangled with an animal, it is possible to disentangle oneself only gradually and by considerable effort, extending probably for many days. Freedom usually comes only at the death of the animal, and even then there remains an astral entanglement to shake off. Chapter 17 Healing. We have already seen that a man in vigorous health is continually throwing off from his body vital emanations which may be absorbed by others. In this way the latter will be strengthened, and minor illnesses may be cured, or, at least, recovery expedited. As, however, the currents of prana are amenable to the will, it is possible for a man consciously to direct the streams of vitality which pour out of him, as well as greatly to augment their natural flow. By directing the currents onto a patient who is depleted of strength, owing to the fact that his spleen is not doing its work properly, considerable help towards recovery may be given, the additional vitality poured in by the healer keeping the patient's bodily machinery working until it is sufficiently recovered to manufacture supplies of prana itself. The healing of the weak by the strong may thus be achieved, in certain cases, merely by physical proximity, the process being either entirely unconscious and automatic, or it may be assisted and expedited to almost any extent by conscious effort. Much benefit may often be given merely by pouring into the patient copious streams of vitality, which will flood the patient's system with vitalizing energy, or the operator may direct the flow to the particular portion of the body which is out of health. Merely to increase the circulation of prana is sufficient to cure many minor diseases. All nervous diseases imply a jangled condition of the etheric double, and that is also the cause of digestive troubles and sleeplessness. Headaches are usually caused by congestion, either of blood or of the vital fluid, sometimes called magnetism. A strong current directed by the healer through the head of the sufferer will wash away the congested matter and the headache will disappear. These methods are comparatively simple and by no means difficult to apply, though a skillful healer, especially if clairvoyant, can improve on them enormously. One such improvement, which demands some knowledge of anatomy and physiology, is to make a mental picture of the diseased organ, and then image it as it should be in health. The strong thought will mold etheric matter into the desired form, which will help nature to build us new tissues much more rapidly than would otherwise be possible. A still more thorough method is to create the organ in mental matter, then to build into it astral matter, then to densify it with etheric matter, and finally to build into the mold gases, liquids and solids, utilizing materials available in the body and supplying from outside and deficiencies. A methodical and effective way to set to work to heal magnetically is as follows. The patient assumes a comfortable position, either sitting or lying down, and is instructed to relax as thoroughly as possible. A very convenient method is for the patient to sit in an easy chair, with solid flat arms, the operator sitting sideways on the arms and thus slightly above the patient. The operator then makes passes with his hands over the patient's body, or over that portion of it which he proposes to treat magnetically, making an effort of will to withdraw from the patient the congested or diseased etheric matter. These passes may be made without actually touching the patient, though it is often an assistance to lay the whole hand on the skin gently and lightly. After each pass, the operator must take care to throw off from himself the etheric matter he has withdrawn, otherwise some of it may remain in his own system and he may presently find himself suffering from a complaint similar to that of which he has cured his patient. Many cases of this kind are on record. Thus, an operator may remove pain from a patient's tooth or elbow, only to find himself presently suffering from toothache or pain in the elbow. In some cases, where repeated treatments are given, an operator who neglects to throw off the disease matter which he has extracted may make himself seriously ill and even become a chronic sufferer. A.P. Sinnott gives a curious case of a lady who was cured of chronic rheumatism and then went to live in a part of Europe other than that in which the mesmeric operator resided. 4 years afterwards the operator died, and the old rheumatic trouble at once returned to the lady with its former virulence. In this case, it would seem that the unhealthy magnetism which the operator had withdrawn from the patient, but had not destroyed, had for years been hanging around the aura of the operator, and on his death, has at once flown back to where it originally belonged. Usually it is sufficient to jerk the hands sharply downwards and away from oneself, or the magnetism may be thrown into a basin of water, the water afterwards of course being thrown away. The process may be assisted after this preliminary portion of the treatment is completed by washing the hands in water before commencing the next and more positive part of the treatment. It is also said to be possible to direct the unhealthy magnetism to certain classes of elementals, where it will find its appropriate sphere. The Bible parable of a herd of swine may well be an allegorical description of the process. It would certainly seem to be preferable for something of this kind to be done than for the unhealthy magnetism to be left floating about near the aura either of the healer or of others who may happen to be near. A slight variation of the above method, especially useful in the case of local congestion, is to place the hands, one on either side of the affected area, and to direct a stream of cleansing magnetism from the right hand to the left hand, this magnetism driving out the patient's congested material. The whey having been prepared, the next stage is to pour into the patient one's own magnetic fluid and prana. This is done by making similar passes, though this time with a strong effort of will to pour out one's own force into the patient. This, as before, may be done by means of long, sweeping passes over the whole body, or by shorter passes over a special area, or again, the two hands may be used, the current being passed from the right hand to the left, through the area that is being treated. The student will readily recognize the desirability of the healer being himself perfectly healthy, because otherwise he is liable to pour into the patient some of his own unhealthy magnetism. It should be noted that in magnetic healing, clothing is somewhat of a barrier, silk being in this respect the worst. The minimum possible, therefore, according to circumstances, should be worn by the patient. From the fact that certain forms of insanity are due to defects in the etheric brain, its particles not corresponding perfectly with the denser physical particles and thus being unable to bring through properly vibrations from the higher vehicles, we may surmise that such cases might lend themselves to cure by magnetic treatment. There are, of course, other methods of affecting the etheric body, because the connection between mental, astral and etheric bodies is so close that any one of the three may affect any of the others. Generally speaking, it may be said that anything which promotes physical health also reacts favorably on the higher vehicles. Unused muscles, for example, not only tend to deteriorate, but produce a congestion of magnetism. This means a weak place in the etheric double, through which unpleasant germs, such as those of infection, may enter. Similarly, mental or astral ill health will almost surely, sooner or later, be reflected as physical disease. A person who is astrally fussy, that is, who allows his astral body to fritter away his strength on petty little emotions, troubles and worries, not only is apartment to produce unpleasant and disturbing effects on the astral bodies of other sensitive persons, but frequently the perpetual astral disturbance reacts through the etheric upon the dense physical body, and all sorts of nervous diseases are produced. Nearly all nerve troubles, for example, are the direct result of unnecessary worry and emotion, and would soon disappear if the patient could be taught to hold his vehicles still and peaceful. Magnetic healing blends almost imperceptibly into mesmerism, which we shall therefore now proceed to examine. Chapter 18 Mesmerism. The student should recognize the perfectly clear and definite distinction between hypnotism and mesmerism. Hypnotism, derived from the Greek hypnos, meaning sleep, stands literally for the art of putting to sleep. It usually results from a nervous paralysis brought about by a slight strain either to the nerves of the eye or in some other way. It is not, in itself, an injurious state to be in, though it may of course be turned to ends either good or bad. It frequently makes the subject insensible to pain, and it may give the system a rest which may be highly beneficial. It is primarily a self-induced condition. Its main result is that it usually places the subject to a greater or lesser extent under the control of the operator who, within certain limits which vary according to the nature and character of the subject and the degree of the hypnosis as well as the power and skill of the operator, may be compelled to do what the operator wishes. Mesmerism depends upon quite a different principle. The word itself is derived from Frederick Mesmer, 1734-1815. A doctor of Vienna, who, towards the end of the 18th century, discovered that he could effect cures by means of influences proceeding from the hand, to which he gave the name animal magnetism. The essence of mesmerism is that the operator drives out or forces back the patient's own magnetism or vital fluid, and replaces it with his own fluid. The natural effect of this is that the patient loses all power of feeling in that portion of his body from which his own fluid has been expelled. We have previously seen that the power of feeling depends on the transmission of contacts to the astral centers, through the matter of the etheric double. When therefore, the etheric matter is removed, the connection between the dense physical body and the astral body is broken, and consequently there can be no sensation experienced. The withdrawal of the vital fluid does not in any way interfere with the circulation of the blood, for the portion of the body concerned remains warm. It is thus possible to drive out a patient's own etheric matter from, say an arm or a leg, so that complete anesthesia in the limb results. The mesmeric process being in such a case purely local, the patient will retain full normal consciousness in the brain. All that happens is that a local anesthetic has been applied to the limb concerned. Under such mesmeric anesthetic, surgical operations, both major and minor, have been performed. Perhaps the best known collection of such operations is recorded in the book Mesmerism in India, first published in 1842, by Dr. Esdale. Another surgeon, one Dr. Lietzen, also performed large numbers of operations under mesmeric anesthesia in London about three quarters of a century ago. At this time, chloroform was unknown, and every operating room was a torture chamber. Graphic and interesting accounts of the work of these two pioneers may be found in The Rationale of Mesmerism, by A.P. Sinnett, a book strongly recommended to the student. The mesmeric process may be pushed further, to the extent of driving out the subject's own magnetic fluid from the brain and replacing it by that of the operator. In this case, the subject entirely loses control of his own body, and the control passes to the operator, who can then make the subject's body do what the operator wishes. An interesting consequence of replacing a subject's magnetic fluid by that of the operator is that a stimulus applied to the operator may appear to be felt by the subject, or, on the other hand, a stimulus applied to the subject may be felt by the operator. Thus, for example, suppose that an arm has been mesmerized, the subject's own magnetic fluid being replaced by that of the operator. Then if the operator's hand be pricked, the subject may receive the feeling, owing to the fact that the nerve ether of the operator has been connected to the subject's brain, the subject therefore, receiving the message from the operator's nerve ether, supposes it to have come from his own nerve ether and so responds accordingly. This phenomenon is usually known as magnetic sympathy, and many cases may be read of in the literature of the subject. It is not essential to make passes with the hands in order to mesmerize. The only use of the hands is to concentrate the fluid, and perhaps to help the imagination of the operator. Anything which assists the imagination, making it easier, that belief upon which the action of their will so largely depends. A skillful mesmerist, however, can manage quite well without any passes whatever, achieving his results merely by looking at his subject and using his will. It would appear that the etheric mechanism of the body consists of two distinct divisions, the one unconscious and connected with the sympathetic, the other conscious and voluntary, and connected with the cerebrospinal system, and that it is possible to mesmerize the latter, but not the former. A mesmerist would not, therefore, usually be able to interfere with the ordinary vital processes of a patient's body, such as breathing or the circulation of the blood. This may, perhaps, be the explanation of the statement in Theosophy that prana exists in two main forms in the physical body, energizing prana in the etheric double, and automatic prana in the dense body. As in the case of magnetic healing, it is obviously eminently desirable that a mesmerist should be physically healthy. For a healer or magnetizer pours into the patient not only prana, but also his own emanations, and in this way it is possible for the operator to convey physical disease to the subject. Further, as astral and mental matter are also thrown into the subject, moral and mental diseases may likewise be transferred. For similar reasons, a mesmerist may thus, even unconsciously, gain great influence over his subject, a far greater power than is generally known. Any quality of heart or mind possessed by the mesmerist is very readily transferred to the subject, hence the avenues of possible danger in this respect are apparent. Mesmerism purely for curative purposes, by those who understand what they are doing and can be trusted not to abuse their powers, has much to be said for it. But mesmerism for other purposes is distinctly not advisable. An advantage possessed by mesmerism over healing of disease by will is that when will forces are poured down into the physical, there is a danger of driving the disease back into the subtler vehicles from which it came, thus inhibiting the final working out to the physical plane of evil which has its origin in mind and emotion. Curative mesmerism is free from this danger. An interesting example of magnetic or mesmeric healing is the Buddhist Paritta or Pirit ceremony, meaning literally blessings, in which the monks sit in a circle or hollow square and hold in their hands a rope about as thick as a clothesline, from which strings run to a large pot of water. Relays of monks recite texts from the scriptures for many days continuously, keeping clearly in their minds the will to bless. The water becomes very highly charged with magnetism and it is then distributed to the people, or a sick man may hold a thread connected to the rope. It may be noted, in passing, that it is possible to mesmerize plants and procure specific and distinct results in stimulation of their growth. There are probably very few who practice this consciously, at least in Western countries, though the fact that some persons have a lucky hand with plants and flowers, etc., may perhaps be partially explained on the lines indicated. A more common cause, however, of such phenomena has to do with the composition of the etheric and other bodies and the relationship of the person to the elementals, the most friendly to him being those whose element is preponderant in his vehicles. Nature spirits, possessing little sense of responsibility and wills not strongly developed, can usually readily be dominated mesmerically, and can then be employed in many ways to carry out the will of the magician. So long as the tasks given to them are within their powers, they will be faithfully and surely executed. It is also possible to mesmerize persons who have recently died and who are still hovering close about us in their astral bodies. Chapter 19 Shells and Shields. There are certain circumstances in which it is both permissible and desirable to form either a shell or a shield of etheric matter, to protect oneself or other people from unpleasant influences of various kinds. Thus, for example, in a mixed crowd there is quite likely to be present some physical magnetism distasteful, if not positively injurious, to a student of occultism. Some persons, also, being themselves low in vitality, have the faculty, usually unconscious, of depleting others in their vicinity of their stores of prana. Provided these vampire-like people took from others only those etheric particles which are normally expelled from the body as not needed, no harm would be done, but often the suction is so intense that the whole circulation of prana in the victim is hastened, the rose-colored particles also being drawn out of the system before their pranic content has been assimilated by their owner. A capable vampire can thus drain a person of all his strength in a few minutes. The vampire is not appreciably benefited by the vitality of which he has robbed others, because his own system tends to dissipate what he acquires without proper assimilation. A person in this condition needs mesmeric treatment, strictly limited quantities of prana being supplied to him, until the elasticity of his etheric double is restored, so that both the suction and the leakage cease. The leakage of vitality takes place through every pore of the body rather than through any one portion of it. In certain abnormal cases, another entity may attempt to seize and obsess the physical bodies of others. Or, again, it may be necessary to sleep, for example, in a railway carriage, in close proximity with people of the vampire type or whose emanations are coarse and undesirable, or the student may have to visit persons or places where disease is rampant. Some people are so sensitive that they are apt to reproduce in their own bodies the symptoms of others who are weak and diseased. Others, again, suffer considerably from the incessant play of the multiplex vibrations of a noisy city. In all these cases, an etheric shell may be utilized with advantages to protect oneself. It is important to note, however, that an etheric shell which keeps out etheric matter will also keep it in, and that therefore one's own etheric emanations, many of which are poisonous, will be kept within the shell. The shell is made by an effort of will and imagination. It may be done in two ways. Either the periphery of the etheric aura, which follows the shape of and is slightly larger than the physical body, may be densified, or an ovoid shell of etheric matter may be manufactured out of the surrounding atmosphere. The latter is preferable, though it demands a far greater exertion of the will and a more definite knowledge of the way in which physical matter is molded by it. Students who wish to guard their physical bodies during sleep by means of an etheric shell must be careful to make the latter of etheric, not astral, matter. A case is recorded of a student who made this mistake, with the consequence that the physical body was left entirely unprotected, while he himself floated away in an impenetrable astral shell which permitted nothing to pass either to or from the consciousness imprisoned within. The formation of an etheric shell before going to sleep may be of assistance in helping the experiences of the ego to come through into the waking consciousness by preventing the thoughts which are always floating in the etheric world, and constantly bombarding their vehicles, from entering into the sleeping etheric brain and becoming mixed up with the thoughts of that etheric brain itself. The etheric part of the brain, being the playground of the creative imagination, takes an active part in dreams, especially those caused by impressions from outside, or from any internal pressure from the cerebral vessels. Its dreams are usually dramatic, for it draws on the accumulated contents of the physical brain, and arranges, dissociates, and recombines these after its own fancies, thus creating the lower world of dream. The best method of remaining, whilst awake, practically impervious to the impingement of thought from without is to keep the brain fully employed instead of leaving it idle, the door wide open for the streams of inconsequent chaos to pour into it. In sleep, the etheric part of the brain is of course even more at the mercy of outside thought currents. By the means suggested above, the student should be able to keep himself free from such troubles. In some cases it is not necessary to make a shelter surround the whole body, but merely a small local shield to guard oneself against a special contact. Thus some sensitive people suffer acutely merely shaking hands with others. In such cases a temporary shield of etheric matter may be formed, by an effort of will and imagination, which will completely protect the hand and arm from the entry of a single particle charged with undesirable magnetism. Similar shields are used for protection against fire, though for this purpose a far greater knowledge of practical magic is needed. Such shields of etheric matter, the thinnest layer of which can be so manipulated as to be absolutely impervious to heat, may spread over the hands, the feet, or over the hot stones or other substances used in fire-walking ceremonies still practiced in some parts of the world. This phenomenon is occasionally seen at spiritual seances, the sitters being enabled to handle red-hot coals with impunity. It will, of course, be recognized that the shells and shields we have been speaking about are purely etheric, and therefore have no effect in keeping off astral or mental influences, for which purpose shells of the material of those planes would have to be employed. With these, however, we are not here concerned. Chapter 20 Mediumship. A medium is an abnormally organized person in whom dislocation of the etheric and dense bodies easily occurs. The etheric double, when extruded, largely supplies the physical basis for materializations. Such materialized forms are usually strictly confined to the immediate neighborhood of the medium, the matter of which they are composed being subject to an attraction which is constantly drawing it back to the body from which it came, so that if kept away from the medium too long the figure collapses, the matter which composes it instantly rushing back to its source. Such forms are able to exist for a few moments only amidst the intense vibrations of brilliant light. The condition of mediumship is, on the whole, dangerous, and fortunately comparatively rare. It gives rise to such nervous strain and disturbance. When the etheric double is extruded, the double itself is rent in twain, the whole of it could not be separated from the dense body without causing death, since the life force, or prana, cannot circulate without the presence of etheric matter. Even the partial withdrawal of the double produces lethargy in the dense body and almost suspends the vital activities. This dangerous condition is usually followed by extreme exhaustion, see Chapter 1, p. 5. The terrible drain on the vitality, set up by a withdrawal of the means by which the prana is circulated, is the reason why mediums are so often in a state of collapse after a seance, and also why so many mediums eventually become drunkards, stimulants being taken in order to satisfy the terrible craving for support by the sudden loss of strength. Sir William Crookes, on page 41 of his researches, writes, "After witnessing the painful state of nervous and bodily prostration in which some of these experiments have left Mr. Home, after seeing him lying in almost fainting condition on the floor, pale and speechless, I could scarcely doubt that the evolution of psychic force is accompanied by a corresponding drain on vital force. The condition closely resembles the shock which follows a surgical operation.